The lights are on red. We're away.
Hey, welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is August 21st, and this is episode 191. This is Jules Cisek, and with me is Jim Race and Liam Schubert.
Really?
Howdy, guys.
Howdy.
Hello. Hello out there in MotoGP OD land.
We haven't heard from you in a while, Liam. How's it going?
Good, good. I've been busy.
You're off working on the machine?
Yeah, one of them. I'm working on a very special birthday present. Ooh. For
a very special person.
Yes, that's exactly the way I want to put it.
Excellent. Okay, so we're going to be talking about Brno. We're going to talk about some silly season because it's getting unbelievably silly, and then let's see what else comes up. And Jim, you have an interview for us.
Yeah, I talked to Michael Laverty over the weekend. Michael is obviously one of the three racing Laverty brothers out of Tunbridge, Northern Ireland. And he ran this weekend in the AMA at VIR, but he also runs concurrently, and it's really kind of weird, in World Supersport. So I think it was a really good interview, and he, considering he just stepped off the bike, it was pretty cool that he took the time to talk to me, and so hopefully you guys will enjoy that.
Excellent. So he's going to hear Liam is continuing to work on his bike. On the press.
It never stops. It's not technically mine. It's just one of the projects that we've got going on right now.
So you need to tell us what kind of bike it is.
It's a Honda, believe it or not, because I've always had a thing for Hondas. And
is it a very small Honda?
No. Okay. No, it's not, surprisingly enough. But to me, motorcycles have always been just two wheels and an engine. And however you want to connect the dots, so to speak, that defines a motorcycle. And some motorcycles have character, and some don't apparently or readily have character. I think that's why a lot of Japanese bikes get a bad rap. They're like, oh, it's got no soul, yada, yada. But the main thing is it takes character to recognize character. So I think all motorcycles should be viewed as two-wheeled transportation that you can enjoy or you can push different limits with. Some serve a stylistic function. Others are just, you know, racetrack performance. All motorcycles are motorcycles, you know, and it's just like people. We all come in different shapes and sizes, but, you know, if everything worked out right in the beginning, everyone's got 10 fingers and 10 toes, and everybody's the same.
And they're a driving force in your life.
Yes, they are a driving force in my life. They're one of them, yeah.
Very cool, very cool. So when are we going to hear more about this thing?
Well, I hope to have the engine back together within a week to a week and a half. It depends on if I can source enough special parts for the engine. I picked up this bike and I got it for a song, basically, and took it down every nut and bolt, everything completely apart. I'd found that the piston rings had frozen to the cylinder wall and had rusted out. And the previous owner had tried to get the engine turned over, and the piston rings shattered and
ouch.
Went up past the valves and destroyed the cam drive system, and also went down beneath the piston and destroyed every bearing in the bottom end of the motor. So, you know, what I thought was going to be a little bit more simple as far as a freshening up, so to speak, it turns out it's quite a more complicated rebuild process than I expected. So I think that's why it's not together already. But, you know, sometimes you never know what you're going to get when you're buying used. So, and conveniently, you know, I bought this bike without having heard the engine run because Because the guy I bought it from was so smart that he took the battery out and put it on his charger and left it there on the wrong setting on his battery charger and okay. blew the battery up.
You blew it up or did you melt it?
Yeah, it split. The battery split and stuff came out. So anyway, every piece was taken down. I had some of the larger pieces powder coated at a place near the San Francisco airport. And then a lot of the work I'm doing myself as far as sandblasting and powder coating all the smaller pieces. I just don't have an engine. I mean, I don't have access to an oven that's big enough to handle entire chassis and whatnot. Right. Yeah. But it's fun. You know, it's been a good little project, something to keep the wrenches spinning amongst my other project bikes. And then we've also got, you know, my partner and I have started up our own business. And I guess the larger news is that we will be going into production of certain items soon and waiting on the patent filing process. You know, obviously I can't wait 3 years for things to get finalized. So I'm dealing with thoughts of, you know, should we go into business with a patent pending idea or several patent pending ideas? And it's the kind of stuff that I don't really consider so much in my normal thought process. You know, I have creative ideas, and if I can't learn the skills and how to create it myself, you know, then I seek out somebody that can help me create it, whether that's through using CAD or SolidWorks or something of that nature, or somebody that's a better welder than me. You know, I'm learning the more business side of how to run things as far as protecting myself and my ideas, and also, you know, figuring out where to stay on the side of all the contracts that I've signed previously. And I don't know.
So things are moving along. That's good. That's great.
If you're going to be making parts, Liam, and as long as you have a patent pending, it's my understanding that nobody can do a copy paste like some scuzzball companies like PSR are doing. So I think you're probably golden.
Well, I didn't say anything about parts, Jim.
Okay. Well, just at least try and point that particular thing out.
No, it's been fun, definitely. Cool. I enrolled in some classes earlier this year, and so I'm also working with some advanced composites, and I don't know, kind of teaching myself the next stage as far as my evolution. You know, I can't say that. That I'm getting out of racing, but at the same time, I guess I'm honing my skill set so that I'm just that much more capable of doing things what I want to do in the future. You know, because it's always been a dream of mine to work on and build my own motorcycles, and my career path has followed that since the '90s. You know, when I chose to leave the state of Hawaii, I went directly to the Motorcycle Mechanics Institute in beautiful, sunny Phoenix, Arizona. And I spent 16 months of my life there, you know, riding in the what I call the blast furnace. I guess when you get on the freeway there, there's so much sand and hot wind, and it's always so hot. You could ride in a T-shirt and get off your bike and just be completely dripping and drenched in sweat.
Yeah.
And your face feels like it's been sandblasted if you're not wearing a helmet.
Well, that explains your good looks.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that's why I lost, you know, some of the hair on top. But regardless, yeah, I've been having a lot of fun and cooking a lot more. You know, a bunch of the things that I'd missed out on while I was traveling so much with the circus, I've been catching up on. And had a great dinner tonight that we prepared, fish tacos. And normally I deep fry them. But tonight it was a nice marinated, you know, lime and all sorts of good stuff with the fish and a nice salsa and some jalapenos, and everything came together really nicely. So if I sound a bit slow, it's because I just ate a whole bunch of fish tacos.
I haven't yet had dinner yet, so thanks a lot, dude.
Man, you should have seen the guacamole I made. Nice big garlic chunks in there.
You will stop now.
You're about to break rules. All right, let's talk about burnout, guys.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. There was a race. There was a race this weekend.
Yeah.
In Czechoslovakia.
That's right.
We should really say the Czech Republic. So
there you go. Exactly. I don't know why I didn't catch that before. Jeez. They take that stuff seriously over there.
Oh, they totally do. So we had a race in Brno, which is a we were there with World Superbikes recently, and it's a fantastic track.
The racing was in Brno this weekend, and as you've mentioned before, it was a track that we just visited with World Superbike, and clearly a high-speed, very flowing track, a lot of elevation changes. And we talked about it a lot last week, but we also talked about all the kind of weirdness that there was going on going in. We talked a ton last week about Stoner being out of the series, which is huge news. And we knew that Fabrizio was going to be coming in and riding the Pramac bike, bike you're very familiar with Liam, and I'm sure still are. And it was going to be crazy, and it turned out to be a bit of a crazy race.
Oh yeah, do we know what happened to Fabrizio exactly?
Arm pump.
I thought he had a shoulder, some kind of shoulder injury from practice football.
Right. Yeah, but relatively simple arm pump. They didn't put anything up on Clinico Mobile, but I got a blurb from Doc Costa that was another one of the problems he was having. But he also had a shoulder injury.
I think Friday, right?
Yeah, there was a crash on Friday.
And he tore something. He tore a muscle in there. So, you know, with the forces of the GP bikes under braking, he knew very quickly that he wasn't going to be able to last. And he didn't want to crash the bike, which is actually nice of him, I guess.
Yeah, it's quite noble with the current engine regulation kicking in with Brno.
Exactly.
And just to reiterate for those that aren't clued in, the new mandated rule is, as of Brno and the remaining 7 races of the season, you are allowed to use 5 new engines, which is an early start on what they hope to do for the engines next year, which is limit the amount of new engines a team could use.
For the entire season?
Yes, for the entire season.
To 6 is the number that I'm hearing now. And we could probably go on and on and on about that. But without going into super lot of detail about it, I have some serious suspicions that rule and proposal will probably be modified heavily before the season's up, because I don't think it's tenable.
Yeah, I don't think it's a viable option when traditionally everything's been changed with a minimum of 1 new engine per rider per weekend. And the level that these engines are tuned to, I think if you look at a tuner that's working in Superbike or, you know, AMA Superbike, whichever, if you had to say, okay, we're going to take 180 horsepower Suzuki Gixxer 1000 and we're going to turn it into 230 horsepower, you know, that 50 horsepower more that you're going to make comes at the cost of engine life. And that's in the most simple terms I can put it. The metallurgy required by the engines that reach a certain temperature or a certain RPM are just extreme. And a lot of people don't realize just exactly how different and conservative the street Desmosedici is compared to the race bike.
Right.
You know, and we're not talking about just the piston rings and the pistons, but it goes down to the connecting rods and the crankshaft and everything else involved. Because as we know, like links in a chain, you're only as strong as your weakest link. So everything gets modified. And, you know, the first time I heard the engine rule, I thought it was a bit of a stretch to change mid-season, you know, without the time of testing and just manufacturing new parts. You know, say somebody in the factory has an idea like, oh, okay, perhaps we could change this or reduce the strength of this, or we'll beef up that wall and aiming to get more engine life out of the current package. you know, it takes time to get specialist companies to produce the material, which you've then got to test. And all these factories, you know, from the biggest one to the smallest one, are going to be doing lots and lots of testing, because no one wants to put in all the effort of shipping everybody around and designing a bike if the engine won't last the race. That's totally the biggest biggest black eye you can get.
Well, and the crazy thing is that they're coming up with these rules that are in theory designed to save money, and what they do is they end up costing everybody a shitload of money to try and do something to work within the rules.
Well, that's kind of a chicken or the egg conundrum, because in order to affect change, it's going to cost money whichever way you want to go. Unless there was just a blanket change like, okay, there's going to be a lot less time on the bikes and less races and less testing. And already this season we've seen one less race. There's only 17 this year as opposed to 18 the previous couple of years. A lot less testing time. And this was the real idea behind Brno, in my mind. Like, I wasn't necessarily looking forward to the race this weekend as much as I was looking forward to Monday's test. Mm-hmm. Because to me, that's always a good indicator. You know, people come out and show what they've got, or take a step forward when you've got a full day of testing. Particularly this year, with the lack of testing they've had earlier, this would have been the time, because you could have had 8 hours on track, and that's a lot of time to work through things.
That's also 8 hours on one of these motors, but the weird thing about the test day was that they were allowed to use both sealed and unsealed motors. So it was kind of still a bit of a they're trying to figure out the rule themselves.
Well, it would have to be, I would expect, because let's say you wanted to test some of your engines that you wanted to use for the remaining five engines that you were allotted. Or four engines if you used one at the Brno race, which I'm sure everybody did. You know, it has to be open. Testing needs to be open,
right?
In order for people to come up with solutions. It was an interesting race. I mean, definitely the biggest shocker that we've seen in recent years is that a key player in the championship is sitting out some races, and. You know, no one is 100% sure why, and probably we might not ever know, you know, the public. You know, so we've lost a key player in the championship, and the remaining two that were in it, Lorenzo and Pedrosa, were left to take up the challenge. And, you know, it's kind of funny, just like last year when Casey got out of the Brno race, Elias managed to score a podium. Mm-hmm. Was at the same time when Solo Moto, the Spanish magazine, had him on the cover a large article on him in the magazine saying, you know, he's going to Superbike. Everyone's saying he's going to Superbike. And he was saying in the interview that, no, I deserve a place in GP. Watch this. So bang, comes the podium. And, you know, he did it again. You know, it seems like the timing is uncanny, but, you know, perhaps he studied under Carlos Checa. I'm not sure.
You know, this year is kind of weirdly, and because we had a season that started late, as we've seen, or as opposed to seasons that we've had in the past, and so the summer break wasn't what it normally is. You know, we only had, you know, had 2 or 3 weeks, and usually it's right after. Right at the end of the summer break, like Laguna Seca, for example, in the past, where a lot of decisions were made as to where people were going and whatnot. And it wasn't this year until Brno, until the silly season has really started hotting up and getting incredibly silly.
I think part of it is also that the Stoner bombshell has kind of really shook things up, because we were basically waiting for Lorenzo to pick his spot, whether he's going to stay Yamaha or not, and then everything was going to start to fall into place. But now, with Stoner gone, And these rumors, you know, of Lorenzo talking to Ducati, everything's open again. The table is completely, you know, a mess.
Well, you have to look at it from the point of view that even if Stoner was in it and was not sitting out races, would a team like Ducati speak with Lorenzo? Of course they would. any team would try and speak to anybody they could get if they felt it was a better option for them than what they had. And if you look at a rider like Lorenzo, and this is not to bag on Nicky Hayden, so no hate mail from any Nicky Hayden fans, but you know, if you had to look at what Nicky's done earlier this season on the Ducati, and you know, and his career so far in MotoGP with 5 years on Honda, and you look at Lorenzo coming in and immediately making an impact in his very first race, and the first four races were incredible as he adapted to a bigger bike, a stronger bike, stronger brakes, more traction, and more grip. What he was able to do on that bike, it would lead you to think that, wow, if he got on this bike, he might be able to do the same thing. You know, that he was able to come in so fresh-faced and make a make such a big splash and be such a contender. You know, obviously the factory, the Ducati factory, would be interested in a rider of that capability.
But it probably would not necessarily be giving him an offer like, you know, this is just rumor, but the rumor is that the offer is pretty high.
Yeah.
And you know, Yamaha's kind of done with their offer. They put it down on the table and it's just sitting there waiting to be signed. So I think that if they were looking, if Stoner was at state and if they were looking, if they were talking to all these different writers, I think they probably would have given Lorenzo like a, you know, maybe something a little sweet. But now they're giving him something really big. So now he has to, you know, decide whether he wants to stay with a bike that's proven, that he's been proven to be able to win races on, set a shitload of positions, pole positions. I mean, he hasn't been off the front row yet, right? This year.
The even freakier thing about it is that because apparently Romanelli has been kind of pushing back a little bit against Ducati, is now apparently they're going after Pedrosa, which makes...
Oh, yeah. You know, it's getting so freaking crazy. Pedrosa on a Ducati? Wow.
Well, yeah, I hear all this talk, but the bottom line, you know, and I see this written on forum after forum, people bagging on the Ducati. Well, it's only a bike that Stoner can ride, and they're only working on it for Stoner. And I've said before, you know, it makes sense for the factory to keep developing it for Stoner because he's the one winning races on it.
Right.
And wouldn't you rather put your eggs in that basket, knowing you had a chance to fight for the championship, rather than sacrificing maybe his bike so that everyone else could get into the top 10. The bottom line is still that the bike is able to circulate the racetrack at Rossi speeds because Stoner can take it to Rossi at the same pace, sometimes faster, sometimes slower, but generally he's right up there. Mm-hmm. So we know that the bike is capable of doing that.
No, and I think, I mean, I've been saying all along, like, that there will be a guy that comes up. There'll be a rider that comes up and be like, oh, yeah, I get it. We just haven't had that person because if you look at the people that have been riding the bike, the only people that I think, the only one rider actually that I really was surprised had trouble with it was Caparossi. Because Caparossi seems like a kind of guy who kind of is able to ride a little bit through problems. I mean, you look at him on the Suzuki, I mean, he's ringing that thing as far as it can go. I mean, especially compared to Vermeulen. But everybody else, you know, I mean, Melandri, I wouldn't say has... I mean, Melandri's a great racer, but I wouldn't say he's ever proven to himself to be able to take a machine that's difficult to ride and tame it. Certainly he hasn't been able to tame the Desmo. And the other guys don't have a history of being, you know, very successful in races, so... Which Lorenzo obviously has.
Yeah, I suppose some of this comes down to the philosophy of the factories behind the bikes. If you look at Honda, it's traditionally been a motorcycle company that makes a bike that's easy for everybody to ride well. You know, and this is from their bottom-of-the-line street bike to their CBR 1000. It's always been, you know, a good all-around package. And that philosophy carries through to their race bikes. I don't really see them making these outrageous race bikes that are just absolute monsters. You know, they always seem to be working on the balance, creating a better balanced machine. And you know, when they started really applying their center of gravity thought processes to the bike, and they brought everything inside and made it even more compact, I thought that was not as crazy as everyone was making it out to be. I thought, well, all right, they're bringing the package in smaller. If it's tighter in between the rider's knees, you know, then the rider's able to manipulate the bike even further, you know. Jim, you can back me up on this. When you've ridden your 250 around the racetrack, you can wing that thing all over, you know. When you get on a bigger bike, and it's like, well, now you've got a little bit more of a boat to move around. But then when you get onto the smaller bike, it's like, wow, you know.
Yeah, it's like ripping a dirt bike around. No, I know exactly what you mean. Just having the, I guess the term would be flickability, and that's something that the GP bikes have in spades.
Right. Difficult for me to say, because I've always had some differing thoughts than some of my chief mechanics as far as what we could do to make the bike more rideable. I know that aerodynamics plays a factor, but I also know from having ridden dirt bikes and supermoto that wider handlebars give you more leverage. And, you know, there are sometimes in every championship where you just have to get it back to the basics. You know, at the end of the day, it's an engine, two wheels, and a handlebar. And the rider does the rest of the job, you know?
I have a very basic question for you, because I've noticed it this year, and this has nothing to do with anything current, but I'm sure you can answer. I think you can answer it. I've noticed a bunch more this year that I'm seeing bikes with perforated fairings, even in conditions that would not normally warrant it, you know, high side winds. And I'm surprised by that. I'm not sure in it. One of the perforated fairings with the big old holes in them that you normally see at places like Phillip Island, where you've got major winds and, mm-hmm. you know, I'm surprised that I'm seeing more of those. Any thoughts on that, Liam?
I think it has to do with rider preference, honestly. When you have side winds, and it depends on the track, whether or not you have really long, fast sweeping corners where you think you could pick up a few tenths here and there, or if the wind is high enough that it's destabilizing the package, then you need to cut down on your body work. And some riders don't like having extra wind force on them, whether it's from the front or the sides. You know, some riders really like to have the bubble, you know, like a big front fairing that they can always hide behind. Other riders don't necessarily need that as much. Jules knows from the track day we did a couple months ago that I don't really care whether or not there's a big fairing on my bike or not.
Well, you know, it would never be behind it anyway. I'd like to suggest that we don't go down the rat hole of talking about the DMG, because we're gonna be here for an hour.
I wasn't gonna go there either. But what I will say, and has nothing to do with Buell or DMG, is that I think that Aprilia's original intention for the RSV4 was GP and not World Superbike, where they are now. So. I don't know if there's a comparison to that, but that's
what makes you say that, Jim?
Yeah.
Well, because of the amount of technology that they put into a street bike that is selling for not a whole lot of money, and I mean the bike really is about the trickiest street bike that you can find.
I would agree with that, but I wouldn't say it's any kind of outrageous GP level technology.
It's the highest V4 on the market by far.
It only revs to 14.2.
Well, now.
Seriously.
I think what Jim's saying is that it started at, in some drawing room, it started maybe as a GP bike, and then they were like, you know what? We'll do better.
We need to make money.
Yeah, that's kind of my thought.
It's an interesting theory. But you know what? Let's talk about the race.
yeah, there was a race in Brno.
Yeah.
Who won?
That Rossi dude.
Seems like he does that a lot.
Yeah, so you know what just occurred to me as I was looking at the championship classification is that there are only two riders that in the top 10 at least that have three DNFs, and one of them is Dovizioso and the other is Lorenzo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? So all this...
Well, you know, I think both you and I, Jules, said before this race, it's like his race to lose. He's running too well. He's going to crash. And that was the unfortunate end result of what happened during the race.
I think he went out on lap six, right? On the third corner of lap six.
Yeah, it was far. I think it was a little bit farther than that in the rest. But well, you've got the numbers in front of you. But the crash itself seemed to me very weird in a way, because he entered so far off, he started entering the corner so far offline, and when he fell, it wasn't from too much lean angle. He clearly was out in some dusty portion of the track and just lost.
I think he knew that Rossi was going to pass him the same way that he just passed Rossi on the previous lap. It was exactly the same place, and he didn't want to get passed, so he just waited and broke too late.
Yeah,
and you know, he could have just slotted in behind Rossi and did the same thing to him on the next lap. So I that was kind of again, I think the lack of experience is what got him. It's not lack of skill or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, when it happened, you know, I was probably like everybody else out there. I'm like, no, but it did seem like just kind of a dumb fall.
Yeah, it was dumb. So what do you think, Liam?
I think things happen in the heat of the moment, you know, and that's when the experience will have the cool head. It's really not a good place to be hounded by Rossi.
Yeah.
You know, I can't think of the worst position to be in is to be hounded by that guy, because he's made so much of his career by doing just that same thing.
Which is why, wouldn't it be better just to follow him around? I mean, we weren't even halfway through the race. And obviously, Lorenzo had the pace to keep up with Rossi, so.
Yeah, I mean, this is something he'll be analyzing for himself after the race when he watches the replays and talks about it with his personnel. But fundamentally, you can't change the rider. If the rider thinks that he's got to be out front and pushing, he's going to do just that. You know, and we see it with Casey all the time. He's got to get out there and just get ahead and keep pushing. And, you know, this reflects back to Barcelona in 07, where we saw Rossi doing all the Hail Mary dive bombing into the corners, trying to upset the rhythm, just trying to do a block pass, doing everything he could to get Stoner off his game. But Stoner, rather than just sit back and shadow Rossi until the closing laps of the race, said, no, I'm here, and I got what it takes. So we're seeing the same thing from Lorenzo. I think he knows deep down he has what it takes to go toe-to-toe, and he's got the machinery and the tires. So he's gonna do whatever he wants to do. He's the guy. You know, once the race starts, it's him, nobody else.
Do you think, so at least in my mind, Lorenzo at Sachsenring this year ran a really great and very, very smart race. He didn't win, but I thought that he ran a very smart race, and it was, you know, toe-to-toe down towards the end, and basically Rossi outbroke him in an area where Lorenzo had outbroke Rossi earlier, turn one, I believe.
Also I think that the thing that really decided that race was that in the very last plunge down the hill, Rossi took a slightly different line blocking where Lorenzo was going to go, and Lorenzo went a little deeper to get a drive out, and he almost did that. Almost worked on the last corner. He almost. I mean, if the finish line was a little bit further, I think he would have passed Rossi because he was definitely catching up to him. He had a better drive.
Yeah, that was tight.
But I mean, my point being is that he ran a really smart race there for the most part, and
He almost pulled a gibbernel on Rossi there.
Yeah, and it seemed like he fell off his game at this race too early.
Well, it happened to Casey last year.
Yeah, true.
In the same place, in fact, I believe.
Yeah, way out in front, doing his thing, and, you know, who's to say exactly what the reason is? Rider error, pneumatic error, nobody knows.
Well, they know. He's not going to tell us.
Somebody always knows, damn it.
It's the data guy. The data guy's going, son of a bitch, I told him not to do that.
Could be. I remember hearing data guys saying, oh, you know, he was 3 kilometers faster into the corner that time.
Yep.
You know, before something happened. And you're thinking, while you're repairing the bike, you know, 3 kilometers, not going to win the race in that corner, fighting for 10th, you know, or whatever.
Speaking of bike repair, Stoner has to be sitting at home shaking his head if he ever thinks he's going to get back on the bike this season.
Yeah, because he's only going to have 2 motors left by the time we're done.
Well, it depends. If the motor is viable, they're going to use it, you know, and I'm sure that's what part of the testing was on Monday. You know, check the engines.
That's a good point, you know, because it, and thank
well,
you.
Hang on a second. They already sealed 4 of their motors.
No, but that was the stuff that we got, and David and you and I talked about an email, was they allowed them to run unsealed engines on Monday.
Yes, but they don't open up engines that they've already sealed.
No, you don't have to open up an engine to see if it's working.
Yeah.
Just put it in the bike and go.
Right, but the thing is that the ones that they were – I'm assuming that the ones that they were using in the test.
They were. I see your point.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be that 5th engine or one of the sealed engines. But
you don't use the same engine all test long.
Of course, I understand.
Typically.
Yeah.
And it's possible that they just went out and did 5 laps and then said, okay, now we're going to analyze the data and the acceleration rates. And if everything looks the same, we're just going to put that engine on the shelf and we'll keep it as the backup.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
You know, so that nothing goes to waste. Especially for a small factory like Ducati, they really know how to make things work and make things last, and they're really resourceful when it comes to using everything at their disposal.
Let me ask you this, Liam. You obviously, we've had riders that have crashed and have picked up the bikes and they were able to get them going again. Is there a mechanism that actually gets the engine to stop so that you don't, because obviously the engine is meant to rotate in a vertical way, I mean with some lean angle obviously, but not on its side. You don't want to have it running on the side for too long. So is there any kind of automatic shutoff?
Yeah, there should be an automatic kill if the bike is stationary, leaned over, and running it.
So street bikes have, a lot of street bikes, and especially the high-end like liter bikes have tip-over sensors, which essentially will stop the engine if the bike's on its side.
Even fuel-injected Harleys have had that for a decade.
Yeah, but I mean, those can also be a bane of racers. A lot
right.
of times,
that's why I'm asking.
Connected,
because then you want to pick up the bike, you run over the bike, and it's not running anymore, and you're like, ah.
Well, it goes back to the philosophy of having an engine that's going to finish the race,
true.
Or an engine that's going to crap out on the race. There was a rumor years ago that used to say Honda told their riders if you crash and you can get up and the bike is still working, you're not supposed to continue in the race. Because it was felt that if the engine was running while it was on its side, either side, maybe oil wouldn't get to a certain place,
exactly,
or
right.
Internal damage could have occurred to components in the engine. And they didn't want somebody to try and continue the race only to have the engine DNF them. So they were told, okay, if something happens, you know, don't use the bike. And it was also said that Yamaha had something similar, but I can't confirm that, either for Honda or Yamaha. We've seen riders crash and get up and ride their bikes again and continue in the race. And to me, that's always been the better track to take as far as a rider that wants to compete, or just the shows you the character of the rider, that even though he knows he's going to be in last place and 45 seconds back, I love it when they get up and continue with the race and put in hard laps. I think a good one is Vermeulen back in Turkey.
Oh, I remember that, when he was on top of the what's his name, Pedrosa's bike.
Yeah, so it's tough to say. You know, obviously the rider is the one that's going to make the decision. When he gets the bike up, if he can get the bike started or if the bike is still running, he makes the choice by examining things and saying, all right, I'm either in or I'm out, or I'm going to come into the pits and let them change a foot peg or a lever or whatever, you know, and just get some breathing time just to collect themselves, because it's never an easy thing to crash a motorcycle and then say, all right, I'm back in it, you know, and not have fear or nerves.
Or unknown damage to the bike. You know, the crash that happened with Callio and Melandri a couple of laps from the end was one of those ones in retrospect, and especially watching in slow motion, I was just totally holding my breath, because it was, you know, basically Callio rode the bike and the back tire almost all the way to the kitty litter, and then he got pounded by it. And I'm like, that's one of those circumstances where it's really easy to, you know, he's already lost a finger or part of a finger. It looked like he could have lost a hand. It's kind of scary.
That was a weird crash, and a lot of people have been talking about this on the forums and stuff. And because he had a similar incident last year in the 250s with his teammate who was at the time Aoyama, and I think it was at Assen. I'm trying to think, but Aoyama was going through one particular corner a little bit slower than Callio because he was setting up a different kind of drive for the next corner in a set of S's,
right?
And even though Callio was following Hero for quite a while, it caught him by surprise, and he hit the back of him, and he was making all sorts of comments afterwards that it was Hero who, like, you know, brake checked him or something like that. And this is kind of a similar kind of thing, because it was clearly not Melandri's fault that the crash happened. He just, you know, he overtook Callio and was then came back into the racing line, and Callio was very, very determined to repass Marco, and you know, they kind of coming together, and that incident in the gravel was kind of bizarre, because I just expected him to run over and say, I'm sorry, buddy. Instead, he started shoving Marco around like it was his fault. But, you know, this is one of those heat of the moment things, like, you know,
they're both pissed because they were having a great race.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
Angie was going to be get a top six, you know, so.
Until he got ass packed.
Language.
Hey, that's a term that I'm used to. That's, in fact, I even use. Well, so to speak.
All right. Well, speaking about rider incidents between riders, we've got a whole bunch of 250 guys that are poised to move up.
Yeah, we do.
And a lot of them have had incidents in the lower categories that were suspects, to say the least.
Are you speaking of one other Marco and a certain Barbara kind of person?
I am indeed. We've got a guy in Marco Simoncelli that's known for riding maybe beyond his personal space. We've got a rider named Hector Barbera that will be riding the Aspar Ducati, the fifth bike next year, who has also made some interesting choices as far as line selection.
I'm loving this verbiage. Keep going, please.
And then we've got Bautista, who, as we saw after the 250 race, I don't know if you guys saw it, but I'm sure you did.
He did some really interesting tricks on that bike.
Yeah, yeah. He said farewell and thank you to Aspar, in quite possibly the nicest way he could, because as we know, Bautista is moving to Factory Suzuki next year. Simoncelli is moving to Grassini. Barbera will be riding the Ducati next year. And of the top four that are in 250 right now, we're waiting on Hiro to figure out where he's riding next year. with the much rumored extra Honda to be coming down the pipe, which would be a really neat, really, really neat comeback story for him after his falling out with Honda when he went to KTM.
Wouldn't it? Yeah.
So I have my fingers crossed for that for him, because I've always believed he's deserved a place there. Whether or not he's going to be a race winner or a game changer remains to be seen. But I think if we can bring someone like Barbara, then definitely Aoyama deserves a place. Speaking of which, Takahashi got a place, and I never understood why it was him instead of Hiro that went.
Well, I think Hiro wanted to stay in the 250s an extra year because he knew that he had the chance of actually winning. Well, I don't know about winning the championship at the time, but certainly winning races.
I think if you have a good option to go to GP, you take it.
How old is Hiro?
I believe he's 28 now.
No kidding. My God, he looks like a kid.
You and he were pretty good friends when you were in the series last year. Do you still talk to him a lot?
Not a lot, but yeah, we were friends for the entire time that I was over in Europe. I met him just a handful of days after I'd arrived in Spain. We met at Danny Pedrosa's birthday party dinner, and we remained friends since then. So I know he's had offers to go to MotoGP before, and some were quite lucrative, and others were maybe not the best option for him at the time. So I don't really want to get into it so much.
Sure.
But I hope he gets a solid ride next year. If he does stay in 250, I couldn't see, you know, who would have the ability to challenge him next season.
I really like Hiro's composure. I mean, he's a really nice guy in real life, but he's also just very cool-headed on the track. Perfect example was, you know, in Jerez this year when he beat Bautista.
Bautista, yeah, a bunch of,
you know, Bautista was throwing everything at him, and Hiro just rode his line.
Mm-hmm. He's got a great bike under him this year too. They've really done a fantastic job of improving upon the HRC bike, and that bike is really, really strong at this point. Really strong. Let's see. Can't talk about that. Yeah, just between.
Yeah, thanks, Liam.
So yeah, Bautista. Wow, that was quite the over Biaggi.
The best comment I saw was that he outmaxed Biaggi.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, woo, tires off the rims even.
It's been a while since we had a guy go into the Parc Fermé without his motorcycle.
It hasn't been that long. Didn't that happen? That happened at Dunnington, didn't it? I forget who didn't show up with his bike. Somebody's bike didn't make it back to Parc Fermé. Took forever.
You mean like ran out of fuel?
Yeah, or something like that.
Yeah, no, it got pushed in.
Okay,
I remember that. But no, right. I'm like literally here comes the rider, you know, on foot. Hey guys, sorry about the bike.
You know they must have been watching that on TVs too. Because when you walk in, it was kind of the walk of shame.
Yeah, yeah. It was brilliant. It's very funny. Very, very funny. And we'll have actually links to some YouTube videos that
haven't been taken down
fans
yet.
The fans have put up some videos.
The side view from the stand. This one was awesome. Sure. Great.
Okay, as far as the race, I think this basically wraps the championship up. So for the rest of the season, we're just going to be watching, you know, see how many more races Lorenzo and Rossi could win.
You know what's funny is because last week, Jules, you and I were like, you know, okay, well, it looks like we've still got something good going. And we would have if what happened with Lorenzo hadn't happened.
Yeah, even if he had been second, I mean, it was it's clear that the, that those guys were fighting for first and second, and, right. and no one. I mean, Pedrosa was what 11 seconds behind, and that's including Rossi slowing way down on the last lap because he was 15 seconds ahead, I think, at the end of the penultimate lap, and then he just started, you know, messing around and doing wheelies up the hill.
Now that being said, the you know, it's not like we're going to just take time off and only do World Superbike races, but
no. I mean, there's going to be exciting racing. I think the championship is this is where we kind of know where it's going.
Sorry, there's one thing about this race that we've totally forgot to talk about, which was actually a really kick-ass battle between Elias and Dubby.
Yeah, they had a great battle. That's right. Actually, and Caparossi kind of was in there as well because he almost pipped Dovi at the end.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned Elias at the beginning, and we kind of, you know, intimated that he only rides well during contract time, but which is actually over at this point. But that was still really fun to watch. I mean, that was the battle for like the last half of the race.
Yeah, yeah. And Dovi actually took over third for the last few laps, and then I think Tony got him like two laps from the end and kept it. Well, I mean, it was a good little fight. Elias came out on top. He has a good record here. He came in. He's a confident rider here. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing him in Estoril.
Yeah, he's done well in Estoril before.
Yeah, we know that.
Yeah.
Hey, Liam, how much do we think that it's he rides really well for when it's contract time as opposed to just gets better as the season goes on?
I think, in my opinion, I think he rides better when he's got something to lose.
Okay.
So, you know, in the beginning of the season,
I was going to say that he just rides well at tracks that just happen to be towards the end of the season.
But we've seen Estoril at the front of the season before, also.
That's true.
Yeah, and he was doing well, except that he crashed.
Yeah, he was doing pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think with the amount of track time these guys get and that they've had in their careers coming up, that the main difference between the beginning of the season and the end of the season is just getting used to the bike or something clicks or they need the rest break of a summer break in order to come back stronger for the second half of the season. You know, because then we'd see a lot better stuff at the beginning of the season after they'd come off a nice winter break. I think there are just certain people, certain mentalities out there. It's a personality type where some people perform better under pressure, you know, and in this arena, you know, not having a ride next year provides some definite and immediate pressure. And different people react differently to stress and pressure as we're seeing in the series right now.
Yeah, but he's not the only one. So, you know, there should be other people that are fighting for that spot.
Well,
he's in a big queue for Tech 3 right now, I believe.
Yeah, well, you see a lot of people, you think that they're riding to the top of their abilities week in and week out. And then you see other people that don't appear to be riding to their best every weekend, and you say, well, they're inconsistent, or he just couldn't find his groove, or it was an off week, or whatever. The bottom line is that if you have gone to the top, the front of a race, and done it, then you have that ability. And whether you can channel everything you need to access that ability in future races when maybe the bike's not set up just right, or you don't like the weather condition, or it's not your favorite track, whatever, you know, that comes down to the rider. I think there's a lot more focus on it's the bike. There's too much electronics. There's too much this. I think it goes back to the rider. And I've always maintained that the rider is the main thing, the biggest computer, whatever you want to say. I think much of the responsibility of riding a motorcycle in racing is the responsibility of the rider. So
Pancharal seems to be saying that as opposed to what a lot of other people are saying, is that the rider is a really big part of the bike. And what you just were saying made me start thinking of Qatar last year, because the two guys that stood out from that race, at least in my mind, were Toseland and Lorenzo.
And Dovizioso.
Yeah, yeah. And then you look at the but those two particular guys now, and they're like polar opposites as far as what their prospects are. It's just weird.
Yeah. Well, I think the prospects ended for Toseland, didn't they?
I don't think it's official yet.
Okay. You never know. Maybe he could bring some great British sponsor.
Yeah, that's true.
It seems like everybody that walks in with a couple $1 million right now probably has a pretty guaranteed seat.
Yeah. Yeah. Or if the team is not really there to be winning races, they'll just take whatever.
Yeah.
You know, because it could be, well, we could be mid-pack if we spent $500,000 or $1.2 million or whatever. Or we can just stay in the series and still get some press or whatnot, TV time. But we'll take this guy for $250,000 or $30,000, whatever the contract is. You know, it depends on the team and what their goal is.
You know, there's a couple of Francisco Hernando Ducatis that are sitting quite idle right now. I'm surprised nobody's snapped those up.
I'm sure those have been earmarked already for Aspar.
Aspar, yeah.
Yeah, probably so.
Yeah, well, James is definitely working on his blue steel or whatever this next look is. He's, every time I see a photo of him, he's got this look.
So, I guess the surgeon delivered that.
Yeah.
The surgeon's got it right. I'm happy to see that Loris is still involved.
Yeah. Definitely. I was just going to say, let's quickly wrap up the race. So obviously, Rossi won the race, is now 50 points ahead of Lorenzo. Casey Stoner is only 12 points behind Lorenzo, but he's not going to be racing for the next two rounds. So Danny Pedrosa is at 135, might be able to take over third. Then we've got Colin Dovizioso, close. They're only 5 points apart. And so now let's talk about the silly season really quick. And maybe a little bit of Indy.
Ah, okay. Let's see. Silly season.
Yeah. We talked about it a little bit at the beginning with, you know, Stoner's departure kind of shakes things up, and Lorenzo, you know, possibly toying with this Ducati ride, shaking things up a little bit.
Bautista and Barbera coming over. And, yeah, there's
You just started talking about, Liam, about Loris. So he's apparently signed a deal with Suzuki, or he's about to?
Yeah, I believe he's in with Suzuki for next season.
And that's great.
And let's see. Don't know where little Tony's going. Definitely not sure about De Angelis, but we do know he was fast on a 250. He was the master of getting on the podium and not really getting on the top step.
Right.
A master of crashing out of the lead. Yeah. with his size and strength, he could become a really, really good Moto2 rider.
There's supposed to be something like 40 bikes on the grid next year. Granted, you know, the economy is probably going to dig into a little bit of that, but you're probably still going to be seeing some really huge grids. So there's going to be some seats open.
Well, not even that. I think the level of detail that you can get into as far as setting up a bike in GP at the top level,
sure,
is so much more involved than setting up a 250, that with the experience he's gained in GP, if he steps back to 250 or Moto2, he would be a very smart choice for somebody to take, because I think he has what it takes to be a front runner. And I think if he was a bigger fish in a smaller pond, he'd probably mentally do a lot better than he has in GP so far.
Yeah.
So I think his option of going to Moto2 is going to be there for sure. And the Aprilia is working on a chassis right now for the Honda engine.
I still find that amazing.
Yeah, we were laughing over that last week. It's like, it would be funny if they came in and dominated.
Well, I don't think it would be that funny.
Well, not funny, haha, but more like. Amazing. A bit of a yeah, an amazing, but also a bit of a blunt to Honda's glory that they were providing an engine to a series that another manufacturer is going to win or might win.
Yeah, I think if we step back away from some of the politics and just realize that Aprilia knows how to make a chassis.
Yep.
You know, they've always been very elegant and stylish, and they work. They work well. And you know, whatever the power plant is, whether it's a little V-twin they made or a V4, I think if they figure out how to slot the inline four in there, their bike is going to work. You know, and it'll be interesting to see what Honda HRC comes up with for that motor. We know that Morawaki's had had a design out for quite a while, and it'll be neat to see how much effort HRC really puts into it. Aside from just delivering engines, you know, they might farm out the engines to all their other little specialist companies to build the chassis for, and just figure out which one of the little companies, you know, is doing it best, and then and then work off of that data.
Yep. That's that seems like the smart way to go, and it seems like there are a whole bunch of little companies that are interested simply because it's a series that actually has some pretty decent value for the amount that you may have to spend. Jules and I both hated the idea before when it was floated last year, and now I think both of us have totally come around and are looking forward to it for 2010.
Well, I think I'm just going to miss the 250s. I'm always going to miss the 250s. But I mean, I've come around on the single tire rule too.
Sure. You know.
I'm still not quite there yet. You know, I mean,
basically, it's like it is what it is now, and there's nothing we can do about it. And the racing is good, so I'm not going to complain.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I would have preferred it if they released specs on the engine and just said, okay, we want it to be a four-cylinder. This is the bore and stroke.
Wait, you're talking about the Moto2 stuff?
Yeah. Just said, okay, this is what we want. This is the bore and stroke. Any way you want to get to it, just do it. You know, and then every manufacturer would have the choice of making a V4 or an inline four or however they wanted to package it, a 3-in-1. That's also an option. Square four. You know, I think it would have been a lot more interesting, but probably nobody had the budget to come up with a
engine. That's my exact idea is you know, I wanted the same thing, you know, see a shitload of innovation and companies coming out with some really cool engine designs. But then I started thinking about it. I'm like, and especially where they were talking about the claiming rules and whatnot and the cost restrictions that would be applied to that. And I'm like, you know.
Yeah, impossible.
Yeah. Absolutely nuts. And so then I didn't like the fact that they, you know, assigned it to a single manufacturer, but then I really started thinking about it, and I'm like, this is totally the simplest thing that they could have done for the FIM. I mean, it kind of made sense to me.
Yeah, I think they made a choice based on what they had to work with. Yeah. Would Aprilia come up with a new engine design and get their motor made just after they'd come up with their V4 for the street, and they were pouring a lot of money into the superbike program? I don't know if they would have done it. You know, it would have been a big ask with the current economy. And same thing for Yamaha to come up with a new 600. I mean, they already have an R6. Why should they make another 600 just to go race Moto2 when they've already got Rossi and Spies and Lorenzo? You know, so we wouldn't necessarily see Yamaha jumping in there. Same with Kawasaki. This definitely opens up the door for a lot more smaller boutique houses to create chassis for the Honda engine. And hopefully we do see some design innovation.
I'm waiting for the Buell.
You never know. You know, that guy is definitely...
It's an opportunity.
He makes his own rules.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Now, see, Jules, you didn't have to say that, because now you... I'm going to be the one who said, you started it.
You're not going to be able to sleep tonight, are you?
I won't have a problem with it.
You're going to be tossing. You're going to be tossing and turning going, oh, my God.
How come nobody suggested that for you, Jules, on that thread when you posted up like a total newbie? What kind of bike should I get?
So
why don't you get a Buell?
I'm getting so much shit for that, for saying that, for starting that thread.
Why don't you get a Busa?
Well, it all comes down to a turbo Busa in the end.
Exactly. You need a turbo Busa. What's the budget? What's the rough budget?
$16,000, I believe.
$16,000, yeah.
Well, then why aren't you looking anywhere else but the BMW?
That's what I told him.
I'm not. I mean, what do you mean? Why am I not looking? I'm looking at an R1 because I used to have one, and I always liked the fact that they kind of turned the sport bike wheel around in 98.
Never buy a first year on a new motor.
Fuck that. I mean, my R1 was fantastic. For 5 years, it got stolen. That's the only reason why I don't have it. Otherwise, I'd still have it, and I'd still love it.
Can you imagine spending more money to get something even uglier?
Well, it has to be said that while the technical sophistication of the S1000RR, and I'd be fighting it myself saying that never buy the first year on a new motor, the bike aesthetically is only good if you look at it from one side or another and don't compare the two.
I don't know. I like asymmetry motorcycles.
I mean, you know, the Ducati may look symmetrical. The moment you turn it on and one light lights up. I actually got pulled over by a cop once who was like, hey, your light's out. You got to get that fixed. I'm like, are you kidding me? You've never seen one of these before? They've been around for a while.
Jules, you're not allowed to cut this part out of the...
Really? Okay.
So, yeah, there's a whole bunch of options out there. The CBR, man, that's a good bike.
I'm not buying a Honda.
Why not?
Because I just don't want one.
Are you a bigot?
I don't want one.
He's an individual, Liam. You should know this by now.
Jeez. Jeez, you're gonna end up with a Buell. Then we won't be able to categorize you. We can't pigeonhole you.
Yeah.
You'll be changing the game. You won't be sitting on just
let's
some...
Let's face it, I already have a bright, high-vis, yellow aerostitch, so I'll fit with the BMW.
That's true.
I'll get that yellow one.
You're gonna
They do have a reputation as making a nice commuter with heated grips and whatnot.
Yeah, I was going to say, straight up, heated grips. How old are you now, Jules?
I'm 42. Fuck you, Bill.
No, the BMW actually looks quite nice in person. When we saw it at Miller, it was...
Yeah, it was good.
I like it.
They had the yellow and black one there, and that probably is not the best color combination.
I don't know. I only
remember the silver one. Yeah. I don't know, 16 large for a liter bike. That just seems crazy to me. Like, in my mind, I always think it's $5,000 for a 600 and $10,000 for a liter bike.
Yeah, well, but if I wanted an 848 with a slipper clutch, I'd be paying $16,000 also.
Yeah, that's ludicrous to me.
Hello, this is Jim Race for MotoGPOD, and I have a Laverty on the phone with me today, but it's not the usual suspect. I've got Michael Laverty. How are you doing today, Michael?
Yeah, pretty good.
Pretty good. And we'll talk shortly about because you've just stepped off the bike or stepped off the bike maybe a bit ago. But I want to fill our fans in a little bit about another one of the brothers that we're talking to right here. Michael Laverty comes from another long racing background, probably 13 years. And those of you in the States may have seen a highlight that they did for him on TV last night, which was a great little piece, I thought, and kind of filled it out. But Michael comes from a BSB and BSS background, both with Stobart and BSB and the Relentless Taz team in British Supersport, and has come over to the AMA this year, running with Celtic Racing and Barry Gilsonen's crew, but also ended up with a sort of a double duty, and originally running a one-off with the Holiday Gym team in Miller for World Supersport, and now another full-time gig with I guess, the Echo CRS folks in GP. Does that about cover it, Michael?
Yeah, pretty much. This season's been a bit all over the place because right before I wasn't for a full season of AMA, and then he was happy for me to go and do the couple of World Supersport appearances, and then that turned into a ride to finish the season of World Supersport, which now clashes with the last round of the AMA, which Barry would like me to do. So it's hard riding for a few different teams in different countries, but it's probably been one of the most fun seasons I've had in my career because I've been travelling so much and getting to see so many different places and different racetracks, really. You know, I haven't rode on the same racetrack that I know once at Donington Park World Supersport, but every other racetrack I've been at this season has been a new racetrack to me, so it's been really quite enjoyable and one that I'll definitely remember for a long time.
You're definitely racking up the air miles, man. It's like back and forth. Probably you and Chaz have probably done a little bit of traveling along the same lines. Michael's from Tunbridge in Northern Ireland, and Chaz from Wales, and I know you guys hang out at the track, and it's nice to have a mate over here. You know, you've spent all that time on British tracks, and you know, places like, you know, Cadwell Park and Knockhill, and you know, us Americans get a lot of crap for you know, having these dangerous tracks. But I look at the comparison between some of our tracks and some of the ones you've run on in the past. How would you characterize those?
Yeah, that's the thing. Some people give the American tracks a bit of stick, but I've really enjoyed some of them. This track, the VIR, is actually it's really safe, but it's probably the only track I've been to in America that I haven't enjoyed this season, just because I think it's quite unique and takes a bit of learning, and that's maybe just a different type of bike setup to work around it. But as far as safety goes, the tracks have been every bit as good, if not better, than a lot of the BSP ones. You know, the one in Kansas that everyone kicked off about, to me, wasn't that bad. And it was actually quite a fun circuit to ride around. So, you know, there's pros and negatives to every series that you ride in. But yeah, definitely the circuits isn't one of those for the AMA. It's got some really good tracks like Miller and Road America and Barber, and they're definitely fun circuits. And looking at Laguna and the ones I haven't been to, they look fun as well. So. Yeah, definitely. In my opinion, the AMA circuits are actually probably a step ahead of some of the BSB ones.
You know, two of the circuits that I've raced at in the past. I never raced at Laguna. I've done a fair amount of track days there, but Sears Point is one that comes to mind. I was really bummed that you didn't make it out for that, but I understand with the economy and what Celtic can do. Sears used to be a kind of a hole, and now it's actually not a bad track, though I certainly wouldn't want to race there in the wet. I have run there in the wet, but never raced there. Let me ask you about, you know, I got a ton of questions. Let's kind of go down what happened this weekend, because you just stepped off the bike not too long ago there at VIR, and fill me in on your weekend a bit. I know you said it was kind of tough to figure out. You've had some great runs at various tracks. Mid-Ohio comes to mind, but what happened this weekend with you guys?
Yeah, it was a strange weekend because most of the tracks we've been to since we've got the new bike on the first day, I can generally get to within a second of the pace of the front guys. But this weekend at VIR, it just seemed harder to get there. And we've gradually been chipping away and learning a few things about the way we need to set the bike up. But we just run out of time, really. And then come the second race, I didn't get to run. I had a collision in the first corner and knocked my brake lines off. And that put me out of the race. So I didn't get to see if we had improved it for the second race enough to get a better result. But we had a ninth in race one, and it was okay. But, you know, kind of have been expecting more from myself in the AMA series since we've been fighting and, you know, with... To run with the leaders at Mid-Ohio and Road America, and it's kind of where I think we should be. So I was a bit frustrated this weekend, but like I said, you know, you can't expect to come to every track and click with it on your first visit. So it's been a tough one, but hopefully if I come back here next year, I've now learnt the ropes of the place, and I'll be stronger in the future.
You know, it's been a real eventful day. I just got done with watching the MotoGP race, and I certainly won't spoil you with that, but it, certainly an interesting outcome. One of those racing days where there's so much going on, trying to keep up is kind of difficult. You're certainly, you know, massively focused, as you should be, upon what's going on with you. But let's take a step back and talk about what's going on in World Supersport, because you've joined your brother out there. Granted, maybe not on a top-tier team, but I understand that you are now with Echo CRS, and you're planning on heading back for the next series of races. And I think you even did you guys cement sort of some sort of deal, or did you get a little bit of Brains horsepower aboard that bike?
Yeah, we've been getting some assistance from the Parc Algar team, and I've done three races with the team now, and gradually we've been figuring things out. The first race, it took us really to get the suspension sorted. The second race, we got the electronics sorted, and now the bike's just gone back, and we found a problem with the engine from the last race as to why it wasn't running correctly. So hopefully whenever I go back to the next race, we'll be stronger. But, you know, I've done Kyalami with the Videc team, and I got an 11th place, and that's been the best World Supersport result this year. But now I should have a better bike than I had then with the Videc team, so I'm hoping, you know, I can be getting into the top 10 and hopefully into the top 5. But like you say, it's a bit more difficult whenever you're not on the top-tier team. It's like Parc Algar, Tenkata, and the Yamaha squad there. They are the top five. That's basically, they're going to be the front runners. If I can get close to those guys and start challenging them, then I'll be happy.
You and my apologies for forgetting Vidic. That's Robin Harms' team, right?
Yeah, I filled in for Robin Harms when he broke his collarbone and he broke it in Monza. And then I flew out to South Africa at the last minute thing and rode his bike. And it's quite a good race, battling with Anthony West and some of the regulars. And could have had an 8th position had my bike not overheated the last couple of laps. And I took an 11th, which was quite good for my first race in World Supersport. But I just haven't seemed to had the luck since joining the CRS team to show that kind of speed again. But hopefully that's ahead of us now. We've got 4 rounds left in World Supersport, and now hopefully we've got everything working on the bike, and I'll hopefully get comfortable on it and get the bike dialed in to suit me, and we can get up there. I know it would be a nice ideal scenario to be able to help Eugene out against Cal Crutchlow at the end of the season, but the speed that the factory Yamahas have, I don't think I've even got a chance of running with Cal. It's a strange situation. I look at it, this time last year I was racing with Cal Crutchlow and BSB, and I could match him on circuits, and now this year on the World Supersport I was like 2.5 or 3 seconds slower than him at Brno, and it was like, it's crazy. It's not like it's absolute riding talent that's making that difference. He's got such a good team and good package and full of confidence, and everything's the stars are aligned for him at the minute, and he's so much faster than what I'm going. But I know if all those circumstances fell in my position, then I could do the same. But that's bike racing, everything has to be lined up for you to really get the best out of yourself and your bike and your team. But yeah, that's fair play to him. He's doing a good job, and hopefully it's going to be a good fight between him and Eugene to the end of the season.
Absolutely, and part of me has to wonder if when you ran on that Videc bike, and I can almost guarantee, knowing Eugene as I do now, that he was probably asking you not to channel Robin Arm's persona while you were on that bike.
Exactly. Poor Robin gets a bit of a hard time, although I suppose it is deserved on some of the moves he's made in the past. So he's got a name for being quite dangerous in some of his manoeuvres, but I think he's a strong rider too, and that's just the way he rides, really.
So you didn't like feel a weird haunting come over you the first time you sat in the seat?
No, actually, I had quite a steady weekend. No big mishaps, and didn't take anybody out. So, he didn't have any energy channeling his bike.
we're a little pink glow when you walk in the garage. Well, shoot. So, what are your plans now? You're at VIR, and you're gonna be heading back home again now?
Yeah, well, I'm setting off tonight to travel up to New Jersey. We're going to do a track day at the new New Jersey Motorsports Park tomorrow, just so we can learn the track. And I would like to be coming back for the last round of the AMA, but it just depends, really. It clashes with Germany, and I've signed a contract with the CRS team to finish out the season, so it looks like I'll have to honour that. But Barry would also like me to do New Jersey, as it's his local race, and it would be nice to finish out the MA season on a high after this weekend. It's been a bit of a downer for me, not finishing the last race and not being as strong as I feel we're capable of. So it would be nice to do New Jersey, but we can't split ourselves in two. So at the moment, I'm going to do the track day, then fly home on Tuesday. And then we've got a couple of weeks until we head out to Germany for the last round, or for the next round of World Supersport. So we'll just have to wait and see where what happens with New Jersey and with and Germany, but it's ultimately because of a contract with the CRS guys, I think I'll be there.
Yeah, I think your brother is at Nürburgring, what, today or yesterday, and was, I think, doing a track day with Cal as well, which is, I think that was kind of amusing.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Have you, so you've never run at Nürburgring either?
No, it's a new circuit for me. And so is Magny-Cours and Portimao. So the only track that we're going to in the last end of the season is Imola that I know. We had a test there just the week before Mid-Ohio.
Yeah.
That was during my hectic time of flying between from Italy to Mid-Ohio in one day before the race, and then straight back from Mid-Ohio to Brno, and then Brno back to Kansas. So then I've had a week in California with Chaz between Kansas and here, so it was nice to chill out for a bit. But it has been busy the last 6 weeks. I haven't been home, so it'll be nice to get home on Wednesday morning and just go back and unpack from a suitcase and just live a normal life for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think there's a few people at home that would look forward to see you. Well, listen, hey, thanks for taking your time with us, Michael. And let's try and talk again as the season goes on. And, you know, if we can get some word out and teams be looking for you, that's always a good thing. So have yourself a good afternoon and a good evening. And I'm sorry today's results weren't what you were looking for, but I know there's better things in your future. So take care and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Jim.
Next week, we are going to Indy. And Liam, you're going to Indy?
Yeah, of course. It's a motorcycle race.
Yeah, so we're going to have a meetup at 12 o'clock on Saturday, immediately after free practice 2 ends.
You said 12:15 last week.
Yes, I'm going to say 12 this week because we would have only had about a half an hour. Because I'm probably going to have to get to work at 12:45, which is why I'm mentioning it. And Liam, are you going to make it? We're going to meet at the foot of the pagoda on the Yard of Bricks at 12.
Oh, yeah, I'll see if I can make it.
Be good to see you there.
I'll be around. I'll be around. Look for me in the Chili's. No, what's the name of that Steak and Shake? They have Steak and Shake over there.
Is the dog coming?
Of course.
Excellent. All right. So of
course, my dog makes it to world championship races because he's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. He's a cool dog. Okay, so anything else you guys want to say about me?
I've given you enough grief at this point. Besides, both of you guys are going to the race and I'm not, so I really can't say crap.
Stay tuned for next week's episode where Jules will give everyone a rundown on what it was like to test ride the new Buell 125 CR. Oh, sorry, 1125. Yeah, I just keep thinking how bigger than a liter it is.
I wonder why. Scratch, scratch, scratch. So this wraps. Yeah, Liam, it's great to talk to you. Have it back on the show, and we'll have to do this again sometime with a little less insanity
and chaos. All right. All right, guys. Hey, thanks a bunch. It was fun talking.
All right.
No problem. Bye.